The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Time Magazine issue, dated June 8, 2026. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Time is in dark blue-gray lettering, capital letters, big block letters, and it's superimposed upon another grayish background. There's a person's photo dominating the cover. He's in profile. He wears black. We see him from the shoulders up. His head is either bald or shaved. He's looking downward, and it's Dana White, the promoter. Turning now to the brief. The first article is the brief opener. Power Trip by Charlie Campbell. He may have descended Air Force One late May 13 to the cheers of school children brandishing the stars and stripes and flanked by Tech's most influential tycoons, but it did not take long for U.S. President Donald Trump to be put in his place in Beijing. In their first closed-door discussions, Chinese President Xi Jinping issued a stinging rebuke on American arms sales to Taiwan, warning the superpowers could collide or even enter into conflict over the self-ruling island over which China claims sovereignty. Given that Trump can explode at even relatively trifling perceived affronts, pulling 5,000 American troops out of Germany after Chancellor Friedrich Merz said the U.S. had been humiliated in Iran, it was telling that Xi felt empowered to lay down the law from the get-go. Indeed, the most enduring image from the entire visit is the two leaders standing outside the Ming Dynasty Temple of Heaven, with Trump remaining curiously tight-lipped as reporters inquired whether they had discussed Taiwan. China is beautiful, Trump offered instead. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio insisted U.S. policy on Taiwan remain unchanged. But the optics of the U.S. president, for whom belligerence has long been a badge of honor, appearing awkward and cowed is a stark illustration of the shifting balance of global power. Xi felt he has a license to make discordant warnings, seemingly without concern about blowback or displeasure from Trump's side, says Sung Wen-ti, a scholar focused on China's leadership at the Australian National University. He appeared tough in public in front of Trump and got away with it. That projection of strength may be surprising, given the very real challenges China faces, including an economy struggling from a prolonged property crisis, weak consumer demand, and slowing growth. But China has also proved extraordinarily resilient, with a record $1.2 trillion trade surplus last year, despite U.S. tariffs that peaked at 145%. In April, China reported record monthly exports, rising 14.1% year on year, owed partly to buoyant demand for green tech products from electric vehicles to wind turbines and batteries, demonstrating its ability to not just withstand disruptions from the Iran war, but benefit from it. That includes the soft power rewards of Washington's tarnishing its international image, particularly across the global South, which disproportionately feels the brunt of soaring energy prices. Beijing's contention has always been, America behaves as a thuggish, self-interested warmonger, says Nick Bisley, a professor of international relations at Australia's La Trobe University. And it's like, yep, this ticks the box. Whether fallout from Iran had sapped his mojo or he was merely beset by jet lag, Trump appeared on the back foot throughout his stint in the Middle Kingdom. He did not regale reporters on the long flight to Beijing, and when he posted on Truth Social, it was to defend Xi, who had implied the U.S. was in decline by warning of the dangers of a Thucydides trap when an ascendant power and a weakening one may come to blows. Trump spoke not of statecraft but of deals, touting a Chinese commitment to purchase 200 Boeing aircraft, saying that's a lot of jobs. The White House later said China agreed to purchase at least $17 billion of American agricultural products per year through 2028, on top of the 25 million metric tons of soybeans annually over the same period agreed in October. The headline numbers look very impressive, says Chong Jae-yeon, a professor of international relations at the National University of Singapore. But I would be a little bit cautious because we've seen this movie before, whether the Chinese side follows through. Xi will be gladdened by the sheer number of long-standing bugbears that were given a pass, including religious rights, media freedoms, labor rights, the crackdown on Tibetans and Uyghur Muslims, eroding freedoms in semi-autonomous Hong Kong, and Chinese support for Russia and North Korea. There was not even a sense Trump tried to hold Beijing's feet to the fire on strategic matters such as cyber espionage, IP theft, or the export of fentanyl precursors. Xi's choice of words also spoke volumes. China is never shy about trumpeting its partnerships with scores of nations, even though they're invariably lopsided and wholly transactional. But with Trump, Xi eschewed any semblance of partnership and merely advocated a framework of constructive strategic stability, indicating he has settled that the U.S. is a rival, and while not wanting ties to spiral, is confident in China's ability to hold its own. As Trump departed Beijing May 15, he gave a fist pump at the door of Air Force One, while another cheering crowd waved more U.S. flags. "It's been an incredible visit," Trump told Xi. "I think a lot of good has come of it." But it was difficult to see the trip as anything other than a changing of the guard. The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer, contributing editor. In recent years, voters on both sides of the Atlantic have punished incumbents and establishment parties of both the left and right, in part because they reject politics as usual and perceptions of corruption. In the U.S., Europe, and South and Central America, familiar power brokers have taken a beating, and a disparate group of mavericks, some on the left, others on the right, have emerged. In Brazil, too, though two political giants have dominated the nation's politics, corruption is triggering fresh demand for a change. In April 2018, former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, known as Lula, went to prison on graft charges. He was released in November 2019, The country's Supreme Court annulled his conviction in 2021, and he toppled then-President Jair Bolsonaro in the election of 2022. Bolsonaro's now serving a 27-month prison sentence for plotting a coup to overturn that result. Since he is ineligible to win his old job back this October, his son Flavio, a sitting senator, is now the lead challenger facing Lula. Latest polls show President Lula and Bolsonaro the younger running neck and neck. But corruption allegations have now returned to Brazil's center stage, reviving the possibility that voters on the right might turn to an outsider. May 13, Intercept Brazil, part of a U.S.-based online news outlet, published messages that appear to show Flavio Bolsonaro seeking money from Daniel Vorcaro, a central figure in Brazil's latest fraud case, to finance a movie about Bolsonaro, the father. Film fundraising is not illegal, but any direct link to Vorcaro undermines the Bolsonaro claim that President Lula is hopelessly corrupt. That is why no one should assume Lula and Flavio Bolsonaro are certain to meet in a second-round runoff for the top job, and it is not the only scandal. The Bolsonaro family has long been questioned about real estate acquisitions under financially suspicious circumstances for a price their official salaries would suggest they could not afford. Lula's own son, meanwhile, has been publicly linked to individuals arrested in a Social Security fraud probe and leaks related to a large anti-money laundering and organized crime investigation could implicate members of Lula's cabinet. There are also three third-party candidates in the race. Each remains a dark horse for now, but Lula's intense unpopularity with the right and the damaged Bolsonaro brand are creating space for a wild card. Romeu Zema, a businessman who built his political reputation as the popular governor of Minas Gerais state, leads the center-right Novo Party. Joyous Governor Ronaldo Caiado will represent the Social Democratic Party, and his reputation as a folksy crime fighter might play well with voters who like the elder Bolsonaro but have little confidence in his son. Anti-establishment activist Renan Santos, founder of the Free Brazil Movement, will lead the Mission Party as the plague on both their houses outsider candidate. Zema and Santos have already spoken out on the latest accusations against Bolsonaro, the son. Zema's hopes lie in his strong social media presence and his anti-corruption reputation, while Caiado is a larger presence on television. None of them has yet seen a polling surge, and all must build effective campaigns to break through. Only in September will it become clear if any has a real shot to advance. In the final weeks of the campaign, voters on the right will judge whether any of them has a legitimate shot to beat Lula. For now, Lula remains a very slight favorite, and Bolsonaro's biggest advantage is that the scandal broke 5 months before the vote. If it does not metastasize, he will have time to shift the campaign's corruption focus back to Lula and the U.S.-Iran fight for control of the Strait of Hormuz could cost the incumbent by sharply driving up food prices. But prospects for a third-party breakthrough are higher than many think. Nearly 40% of Brazil's voters prefer a candidate not named Lula or Bolsonaro, both of whom have unpopularity ratings already approaching 50%. And this latest in Brazil's long line of political scandals raises the odds that a political outsider might actually win. Turning the page to In the Loop by Theron Pillay, editorial fellow. In April, a Gallup poll found 18% of all U.S. employees believe it is at least somewhat likely their jobs will be eliminated within the next 5 years because of AI or automation. For employees working in organizations that have adopted AI, the number rises to 23%. At the same time, AI use is growing steadily, with 28% of employees reporting they use AI a few times a week or more. Economists disagree on how AI will impact labor markets, though early research from Stanford has found a decrease in employment concentrated among 22 to 25-year-olds in AI-exposed jobs, such as software development, customer service, and clerical work. But emerging evidence suggests that in some cases, AI is substituting for critical thinking rather than extending it. The implications of that for entry-level work are concerning. As Zana Buchina, an incoming assistant professor at MIT who studies the design of human-AI interactions, explained, expertise forms through effortful engagement. AI systems shortcut the need for that kind of engagement. So essentially, we are killing the path to become an expert, but also assuming experts exist in the world and can operate these systems, she said. Much of the debate around AI's labor impacts to date has focused on the technology itself, how quickly it advances and is adopted, and whether, unlike previous technologies, it will be able to occupy any new roles it creates. But the future of work also depends on what AI does to us, whether it is eroding the cognitive capacities on which the value of white-collar work has historically depended. The DC Brief by Philip Elliott, senior correspondent. Barack Obama is back to making headlines with long magazine profiles and going viral with carefully choreographed made-for-social-media videos. He is urging Democrats to stand up to an unpopular wartime president and raising boatloads of cash. He is encouraging his base to believe in big hope and change while peddling must-have merch and tickets to his big events. Nope, you did not get in a time machine back to 2008. It is all happening again. The 44th president is about to open his presidential campus. Yes, it is more than just a library. And its dean is about to be as ubiquitous as if he were back on the ballot. But what is remarkable about the return of Obama is not just the price tag, $850 million and counting, for a conference center, a vegetable garden, and yes, an NBA regulation basketball court, or the physical size of his 19-acre complex on the south side of Chicago. It is not that big for a presidential center, Obama allies argue. George W. Bush's $250 million complex in Dallas clocks in at 23 acres, including 15 acres of wildflowers. It's that Obama's perch might be the last one to manifest in a way Americans have come to expect in a post-presidency footprint. President Donald Trump is already promoting a skyscraper in Miami that will house his post-White House presence. Concept art shows gold escalators, a decommissioned Air Force One, and a Mar-a-Lago-style terrace that make it all seem more like a glitzy gathering spot for galas than a research hub for future scholars looking for primary source documents. Fundraising is underway for that project, as his inner circle understands that Trump's ability to raise cash might be at its peak as he sits in the Oval Office, ready to do deals to boost his ambitions for his presidential center, which could end up costing $1 billion. "I do not believe in building libraries or museums," Trump recently told reporters. "Could be an office, but it's most likely going to be a hotel with a beautiful building underneath and a 747 Air Force One in the lobby." Meanwhile, former President Joe Biden remains in the very early stages of planting his sapling of a post-presidency in Delaware, a city as yet to even be announced, let alone a site. To say fundraising has been slow would be generous. Biden's advisors have aimed for $200 million for his building, but ended last year with just $4 million, all of it transferred from a surplus inauguration fund from 2020. Planners say they're gunning for an $11 million target by the end of next year. But around Washington, the thinking is that Biden might end up having to settle for a piece of a planned University of Delaware classroom project already named Biden Hall. Most presidents save the legacy building cash grab for their second term, waiting a few months so as to give re-election donors a reprieve. Up until the summer of 2024, Biden thought he was heading into a re-election campaign that would give him plenty of time to hoover up dollars after his second inauguration in 2025. Instead, Biden became an annoyance to the Democratic Party, which found itself scrambling to assemble a 100-day sprint for Kamala Harris. Donors are not rushing to help the 83-year-old great-grandfather at this point, which is why historians may have to bookend the traditional concept of presidential libraries with Obama's buy the books, brick-and-mortar legacy defense. Doors are slated to open June 19, and tickets are already selling out into August. The Brief by Jeffrey Kluger. Last year, the Trump administration shut down the U.S. Agency for International Development as part of cuts by the Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE. A study in The Lancet estimated closing the agency, which provided food, medicine, clean water, and more to over 60 countries, could lead to 14 million deaths by 2030. Now a paper in Science is pointing to another knock-on effect, a rise in violent conflict across the regions and communities the organization once served. What happens is this sudden shock to projects, employment, livelihoods, and wages, says Austin Wright, professor of public policy at the University of Chicago and a lead researcher on the paper. That drives up conflict by effectively creating economic chaos on the ground. To explore what happens when crucial aid suddenly disappears, Wright and his colleagues surveyed 870 regions or communities that used to receive U.S. aid services from March 2024, before Trump scrapped the program, until November 2025, around 9 months after his move. The researchers used two data sets. One tracks global assistance programs. The other tracks incidents of violence across the same areas. The researchers also tallied the amount of aid received by each of the regions studied. The results were striking. On the whole, there was a 6.5% increase in the probability of conflict after aid was halted across the 870 regions, compared with other parts of the world with similar characteristics, but that receive no aid. Protests and riots increased by 10%. Incidents of armed fighting rose by 6.9%. Battle-related fatalities grew by 9.3%. The uptick in violence began almost immediately after the aid stopped and remained elevated for months. There was, says Wright, a persistent change in the risk ecosystem. The authors also looked into the severity of incidents, how many battles were waged in conflicts, for example. That is actually increasing by more than 10%, Wright says. So you're both more likely to be falling into war or conflict. And that conflict is going to be more severe. Regions that had been getting more aid experienced proportionally more violence than those formerly getting less or none. As the U.S. alienates former global partners by stopping the program, China is attracting new friends and allies with its Belt and Road Initiative, building infrastructure in beneficiary nations. We are not the only superpower trying to win favor, Wright says. Once you shut down an organization like USAID, this creates a persistent concern about uncertainty in contracts. There's no easy fix to the downstream problems caused by the shutdown of USAID. You cannot undo what DOGE has created, says Wright. It is not as straightforward as simply turning the lights back on. Here is the View essay. Environment, the Luna Moth That Saved Me, by Kai Coggin, C-O-G-G-I-N, who is an arts educator, certified master naturalist, and inaugural poet laureate of Hot Springs National Park. April 25, 2024, I was walking in the Ouachita National Forest with my wife and other master naturalists, studying mosses and searching for lady slipper orchids, when we noticed a Luna moth on the tip of a dried-up flower stem, dangerously close to a mountain bike trail. She was so still, I thought she was dead. Luna moths are rare to see, especially during the day, because they are nocturnal creatures who navigate by the light of the moon. We gathered around in a moment of shared awe, then carried on. On the way back to the car, I doubled back. The Luna moth had not moved. As I looked closer, I saw a cluster of eggs. I broke the dried stem at the base and brought Mama and her eggs into the car. It's for science, I told my wife. By that afternoon, I had read everything I could find about the species. I placed the Luna moth in a butterfly enclosure. She flapped her tattered wings once and moved closer to her eggs. The next morning, I found her on the floor. Life cycle complete. I did not realize then that in saving this moth, I would also be saving a part of myself. Adult Luna moths live only about a week. They do not have digestive systems or working mouths. They do not eat. All the fuel they have as an adult comes from what they eat as caterpillars. Luna moths are not pollinators and have no beneficial mutualism with another species. Their only purpose is reproduction and beauty, perhaps. I kept the cluster of eggs in Tupperware on the windowsill. It takes about 10 days for the eggs to hatch, and I kept vigil like a devoted monk. When a Luna moth caterpillar hatches, it's smaller than a grain of rice. May 5, I saw the tiniest green movement, another. With a fine-haired paintbrush, I moved 44 newborn caterpillars into a jar stocked with sweet gum leaves. Each day I woke early, gathering leaves and taxiing the caterpillars to clean jars. I leaned into this meticulous work. Luna caterpillars molt into 5 instars, shedding their skin 4 times. Every 4 to 10 days, usually at night, the babies would slow and silk anchor their bodies to a leaf so they could crawl out of their former selves, evacuating the exoskeletons that no longer fit them. As the days and weeks passed, they outgrew the mason jars and the small monarch enclosure we had. We purchased a large butterfly habitat and tucked it into the corner of our greenhouse. Most mornings, you would find me there on a footstool, tallying softly. The stockpile of leaves I gathered each morning was stripped overnight. They grew and grew. After almost a month of this meditation, the caterpillars were as thick as my forefinger. In their 5th and final instar, their green bodies turned rusty pink and they stopped eating to spin a tough cocoon of silk and leaves. I found 44 cocoons stuck all over the enclosure floor and walls, some swaying from twigs like hammocks. Inside, the caterpillar transforms into a wriggling pupa. Signaled by warm temperatures, adult Luna moths emerge within 3 to 4 weeks. On Juneteenth, by sunrise, 5 moths had eclosed, wings open and drying in the sunlight. I wept. Starting on the summer solstice and for many nights following, I opened the enclosure, fluttering with pale green wings, and reached inside to release each moth out into the moonlight. The majestic beings would sit on my hand, their wings would tremble, and they'd lift off toward the moon. Invariably, before each night's release, a few Lunas would get a little romantic, leaving dozens of eggs stuck inside the enclosure. Midwifing these creatures lasted much longer than anticipated. I raised 5 generations, releasing over 200 ambassadors of beauty into our forest. For 16 months, I was dedicated to their protection. As the Luna moths transformed, I did too. Something about the sustained close attention nourished an ache inside me, a place where my inner child finally had a prolonged practice in wonder, not just survival. I softened in this slowness, in gentle communion with another species. Indigenous ethnobotanist Robin Wall Kimmerer writes in Braiding Sweetgrass that paying attention is a form of reciprocity with the living world, receiving the gifts with open eyes and open heart. Observing them led me to see myself and better understand my own story. I had been in a cycle of survival mode, dissociation, and hypervigilance since I was a child. I don't have memories of my childhood in Bangkok before my parents divorced. My first memory is at age 7, looking up at my father in Houston as I hugged his pant leg goodbye. "Take care of your mother and sister for me," he said. My mother will always be a hero to me. She was in survival mode too, a small but mighty Filipina single mom who was raised on a Kalibungan rice farm alone in America, raising 2 young girls. She worked 3 jobs, and we were latchkey kids. There was always a roof over our heads and food on the table. She came to every marching band contest, volleyball game, and swim meet. there just was not much room for emotions, for talking about feelings, for being held in safety. It is cultural, perhaps. She worked hard so we could have a better life. She did her very best and still does. I did not want to worry her, so I kept everything inside, the depression, the suicidal thoughts in fifth grade, the man who pushed himself inside me when I was 13, the guilt, the shame, the fact that I liked girls. I learned how to wear many masks, use sarcasm to make the pain funny, gained weight, disappeared slowly. College made it worse. Wannabe soldiers jolted me awake every morning in a cacophony of yelling. I was the only female drummer in university military band. Hazing was tradition. My junior year, I was expelled from the Corps for violating the don't ask, don't tell policy by fraternizing with a female cadet. I thought she loved me. After I was ousted, the generals made me march around the quad in full winter dress uniform to make an example of me in front of 2,000 cadets. In my early 20s, I numbed myself from feeling. I built an inner world in which to hide, but I did not let anyone inside, sometimes not even myself. I lit up only in the classroom where I taught high school English. At 28, I fell in love with a remarkable woman. We moved to Hot Springs, Arkansas, and made a beautiful life together. I paved my own path as a poet. I thought I had buried all that pain deep enough. But as they say in therapy circles, the body keeps the score. Finding the language of complex post-traumatic stress disorder gave me the intellectual capacity to begin the journey to healing. But the healing in my body came on the wings of a Luna moth and her cluster of eggs. In the stillness of those mornings, my mind went quiet, my breath deepened, and something started to open. Curiosity and joy brought my inner child out of the most hidden corners of my psyche. My therapist guided me through cognitive behavioral therapy, internal family systems, brain spotting, and bilateral sound stimulation that awakens hemispheres of the brain to create new neural pathways. And each time a Luna moth shivered its wings, gearing up for flight from my fingertips, painful memories fell from my shoulders, telling me to keep flying toward illumination. In protecting that singular Luna moth and raising five generations of her lifeline, I remothered parts of myself that longed for that same softness. Metamorphosis is a mysterious act, at once unbecoming and becoming something else entirely. The publication has added this in small print. If you or someone you know may be experiencing a mental health crisis or contemplating suicide, call or text 988. In emergencies, call 911 or seek care from a local hospital or mental health provider. There's also a photograph here, about a quarter of a page. Has a dark background, like black as night. There are green stems, leaves, saber-shaped leaves, bright green, and alighted on top of two of them are three green Luna moths. This is from the Time Out section, a movies review by Stephanie Zakarik. A master applies his colorful palette to familiar themes. Pedro Almodovar is one of our most emotionally generous filmmakers. His glorious oversharing is not beside the point, it is the point. The good and bad news is that Bitter Christmas, which premiered in competition at Cannes, is more of the same of what we have come to expect from him. His recent pictures, 2024's The Room Next Door and 2019's Extraordinary Pain and Glory, have had a ruminative, brooding quality. Almodovar is feeling old, but then who isn't? Bitter Christmas features a filmmaker, Barbara Lenny's Elsa, who has not only lost her creative spark, but is also struggling with debilitating migraines. Even through her pain, she seeks to persuade one friend to abandon her cheating husband and reaches out to another who's lost a child. She also has a loyal, much younger boyfriend, Bonifacio, Patrick Criado, whom she treats as an afterthought, not a triumph of feminism, but evidence of her callousness. All these characters are figments of another character's imagination. Raul, Leonardo Sbaraglia, is searching for the key to his next movie, only to tear a page from the real-life travails of his loyal assistant, Monica Aitana Sanchez-Gijon, who recently left him to help a friend deal with a tragedy. One narrative nests within another. Raul's story, set in 2026, is real life, while Elsa's in 2004 is his creation. But he does not seem to realize other people's experiences are not ripe for the taking. This becomes a metaphor for the selfishness of creation. He too has his own Bonifacio. The Jenga puzzle of parallels comes to feel daunting, perhaps too cleverly artificial. Even so, Bitter Christmas is so enjoyable, you almost will yourself into believing Almodovar is not simply reworking some of his recent preoccupations. In the end, it may not be as deep as it strives to be, but still we come for the colors, the histrionic plots, the faces, the revelations. It's hard to get enough of the too muchness of Almodovar. This is the page that features 8 questions. It's written by Katie Sanders. It's in the question-answer format. Even though it says 8 questions, I've counted them 4 times, and I come up with 9. Tom Hanks, the Oscar-winning actor and filmmaker on his new World War II docuseries, The Legacy of Saving Private Ryan, and his vision for America on its 250th. There is a black and white inset photo here of Ryan. He's got kind of really short hair, except it's not quite a crew cut. He's not really smiling. He's grinning at the camera. He's dressed in a dark suit, possibly black. Again, it's a black and white photo. White shirt and dark tie. What does moral courage look like today? Answer: the best petri dish for tyranny is indifference. We have a choice every day to do something or not. For some of us, it's raising our fist and saying, "Not on my watch." For others, it's giving money. For others, it's continuing to tell the stories that matter. Question: the docuseries World War II with Tom Hanks debuts on History, or it did debut on History, Memorial Day. Can you talk about the significance of that timing? Answer: in Stephen Ambrose's book, D-Day, he talks about what could have been the first American killed on D-Day, a paratrooper standing in the doorway, ready to jump. He never got out of the plane because it was hit by a shell. Memorial Day is about that guy. Question, how are you thinking about July 4 as America celebrates its 250th? Answer, the 4th of July is about the beginning of the two steps forward, one step back process of making our nation a more perfect union. We will never be perfect, but we've had 250 years to figure out how we get closer. The beginning of the Superman show when I was a kid, truth, justice, and the American way. That is what July 4 is about. Question, you narrate all 20 episodes of the series. What was that process like? Answer, it was the opposite of coming in and reading words someone came up with. None of us wanted to say, okay, here's another haiku of narration from Hanks. There was some stuff that as soon as I read it, I turned to the control booth and said, has this been vetted? Is this true? It ended up being a constant education of saying, I did not know that. Question. If American high school students could all glean one thing from the doc, what might it be? Answer. For a populace to say, we did not know our neighbors were being rounded up and sent away, is as though today we would say, I don't see any signs of homelessness in America. No, it is obvious. It is happening. We cannot be complicit in 2026. Otherwise, look what we might recreate. Here's a statement. It is hard to talk about World War II and Hollywood without talking about Saving Private Ryan. And another statement in answer to that one. Saving Private Ryan was the granddaddy. Many veterans who had actually been there were old and leaving us. When I first spoke to Steven Spielberg about it, he said, I'll finally be able to make the movie about Omaha Beach I've been wanting to. The only thing missing was the smell. The visuals and special effects were so tactile. I knew of people who left the theater after 10 minutes. Question, what keeps drawing you back to World War II? Answer, Stephen and I have gone on to examine the themes and moments with Band of Brothers and the Pacific. Now it's more important for this work to speak about. How does this reflect our behavior today? Question, what excited you about playing Abraham Lincoln in the upcoming adaptation of George Saunders' Lincoln in the Bardo? Answer, Saunders is a genius. It took me 80 pages until I finally figured out what was going on. But, oh, my God, the thing that struck me was I do not play so much this grand historical figure on the $5 bill. I play a grieving father that has lost his son. There's nobody on the earth that will not be moved by that. Question. You also happen to be distantly related to Honest Abe, yes? Yeah. Answer. His mother was Nancy Hanks. His cousin was Dennis Hanks. They were from Kentucky, as are my ancestors. It's a nice claim to fame in fifth grade. And finally, question, what makes you say yes to a project these days? Answer, look, I am almost 70 years old. On one hand, it has to be fun. On one hand, it has to be good. But the final analysis is it's got to be worth telling the story. Unless you are somehow illuminating the human condition, I'd rather reorganize my closet. Oceans. Every coral counts. Researchers are racing to save the world's reefs. This is mostly photographs. I'm mostly going to read the captions. The photographs are by Britta Shasinski, and the text is by Simone Shaw. The first photograph is 2 pages worth. It's the aquarium that is pictured filled with smuggled and confiscated corals that now help researchers in the battle to preserve threatened reefs. It's blue. It's very blue. It looks like these two women dressed in hazmat attire with facial masks and white overalls, coveralls actually. They're working with little vials, and they're surrounded by, oh goodness, a few dozen different species of coral. And then in the background, it looks like a big aquarium filled with more coral and fishes. And it's lots of blues and purples. Coral reefs are home to 1 in 4 ocean species, support fisheries, and protect coastlines from storm surges and rising sea levels. And they're at risk. Last fall, scientists reported that warm water coral reefs are passing their planetary tipping point, a threshold that, once crossed, leads to large, accelerating, and often irreversible changes. Photographer Britta Jasinski spent 6 months with scientists across the UK and Germany as they race to make these critical ecosystems more resilient, whether by freezing coral sperm in biobanks or controlling coral reproduction in labs, like the one pictured that I just described. Molecular Collections Coordinator Laura Sieves of the Natural History Museum London and Biobank Manager Louise Gibson of the Institute of Zoology London collect coral fragments to be used in genetic diversity and geographic origin investigations. In the wild, corals release eggs and sperm into the sea during mass spawning events. But rising temperatures are disrupting these delicate cycles. But replicating seasonal temperature changes and natural lunar patterns can trigger these reproductive events in labs. In 2024, scientists at the Horniman Aquariums Project Coral Lab in London successfully spawned and reared the threatened pink sea fan, marking the first time the species was successfully raised in captivity in the UK. It is not a silver bullet, says Jamie Craigs, principal aquarium curator at the Horniman Museum and Gardens. Restoration is not going to rebuild the world's reefs. The scale at which we need to act is just far too vast for the current technology we have. Restoration is about buying time in pockets to give corals at least a fighting chance into the future. Controlled feeding regimens, water quality management, and larval settlement support help researchers improve juvenile coral survival rates before outplanting them into vulnerable reef habitats. These advances also provide critical insights into the species' reproductive biology and resilience to environmental stressors like warming seas and ocean acidification. There's lots of variation between different types of corals, says Jamie Craigs. Some already naturally across the population have a higher thermal tolerance than other species. Now here's one that's being held in someone's hands. It's a very purplish photo, but the coral itself seems to be white and root-like. In aquarium trials, corals are gradually exposed to higher water temperatures, raised by about 1 degree centigrade per day to see when they bleach, expelling the algae living inside them and losing the vibrant color. Many start to bleach when temperatures rise just 1 degree centigrade to 2 degrees centigrade above their usual summer maximum. After the trials, bleached corals are moved back to cooler water to recover. Studies show corals previously exposed to mild heat stress can sometimes become more tolerant in later events. These experiments help researchers understand which are more likely to survive in warming oceans. And here's a photo of what looks like three red squares embedded with circles. 10-month-old trachophilia corals, also known as open brain corals, with diverse genetic makeup attached to a coral frag plugs, mounts that secure them as they grow. Diversity plays a key role in boosting resiliency, making some corals more resistant to heat stress. Gene editing, meanwhile, helps scientists understand which genes are responsible for greater thermal resilience. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest Insurance Group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.